This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Adrienne Hill. There isn't a standard personal finance curriculum in the U.S., which leaves a lot of folks wondering about the basics. When to buy a home? How much can you pull out of your portfolio? Also, if we've learned anything from the finally resolved government shutdown, it's the importance of an emergency fund. But how big should that be? Well, today, class is in session. At the chalkboard, Jill Schlesinger. She's here to weigh in on some of your questions. She's a CBS News business analyst and a regular contributor to our program. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
So we've got a caller on the line, Sarah in New London, New Hampshire. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
So what's fall like in New Hampshire? How's this time of year?
It's beautiful this time of year. It's bright sunshine and crisp nights and gorgeous leaves.
You have good color this year?
Yes, it was good this year.
That's great. Well, tell us what's going on.
My husband and I have always been told that a rule of thumb for saving for retirement is to save enough to replace 80% of our salary. Is that 80% sort of from the pre-tax salary or the take-home salary? And the difference for us is that we're actually taking out quite a large percentage of our income from retirement. So for us, that's a big difference.
Jill, take it away.
This is a great question. I hate these rules of thumb, so I'm going to give you the better answer, which is if you know how much money you're spending right now, then it's pretty easy. You can figure it out and say, hey, we'll probably spend about that much money when we retire, unless there's something big going to happen in your retirement. You're going to downsize dramatically. You're going to move into a hovel or something. But presumably, when we look at those retirement expenses, we do it net of your retirement contributions, because you won't be doing that in the future. The
right.
One thing, though, you may be doing is having a little bit more money to be spending on health care.
And now we currently are raising two children and have all of those, you know, raising children costs that hopefully we will not have in retirement. But then you're saying we would maybe have health care that would be more expensive?
Yeah, I mean, look, you get Medicare when you retire. There is also a cost for any sort of supplemental Medicare, which can run somewhere around, let's just say, $1,000 a month for a couple.
Sarah, how are you thinking about saving for retirement and paying these kids' costs, which I assume college is a big one for you?
That's the big issue, is that we've done a good job, we think, saving for retirement, because we have also heard the rule of thumb of pay yourself for retirement first and then save for college. But now with two children who are teenagers, we're looking at now moving a good bit of that retirement savings into college savings.
Good or bad idea, Jill? What do you say?
Let's talk about the numbers. How much money have you saved for retirement already?
Well, we've saved enough to, we have this little spreadsheet that we use. We probably are very close to being able to replace our current spending level.
And you said you had two kids, and just where are they in the process of pre-college?
Very little time. One is, they're both in high school. One is a freshman and one is a senior.
Where are you guys coming down on paying for or helping your children pay for school?
We would like to pay for most of it, with the exception of student loans.
So are you saying that if you were to reduce or even stop contributing to your retirement plans, the money that you would have could fund college fully for the kids?
It would actually fund a state school fully.
And how old are you guys?
50.
There's two different approaches to this. You know, you've already socked away a lot of money for retirement. One approach might be to say, hey, I'll just keep putting money in. And if I need money for college, I'll just borrow against my retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
Another is to say, you know what? I've really done a good job. I'll pull my contributions back a little bit and use that rest of that money to pay out of pocket as you go along. And I don't think there's a big problem with that. But I guess that if you've done the spreadsheet and you've done the projections and you feel comfortable with it, that's fine. I am always reluctant to just stop contributing, though, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's some token amount, 5% or so, just to keep the money flowing there, even if it's just for tax purposes to reduce your taxable income, because remember, now you're going to get all this money after tax. So your tax bracket could maybe even go up. So
yes,
just be careful about that.
Yeah, I think it really could go up if we stopped contributing completely to pre-tax.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I don't think it's like, and if you come up short, especially for the freshman, you know, if you had five more years before you needed to access that second chunk of money, you know, you really could always do a loan against your retirement accounts if you have loan provisions, and most big plans do, and you can help pay for that. And you can do, you can also sort of see what kind of students these kids are going to be, because I don't necessarily know if I want to like have you stop all your retirement contributions if your kids are going to state school and going to party their butts off for 4 years. Sorry. Is that that's the mean aunt.
No, that's. I hope that they're not that type of student, but one really never knows. But at this point,
exactly.
They don't seem to be that type of student.
Now, have you talked to your kids about the cost of college?
Yes, we've spoken around the dinner table, I guess you might say. So we haven't had an in-depth conversation, but they understand that their job is to get into as good a college as they can get into, and they know that they will be doing loans, and then our job is to help them cover that.
And why are you thinking about this today?
Well, mostly because my daughter's a senior, and we've been putting in college applications. So we sort of took a little, I think it's one of these things that we kept putting off until it was sort of too late to put it off. We really have to think about it now.
Sarah, has this helped at all?
Oh, yes. It's helped a lot. I'm thinking of talking about this new rule of thumb about spending about the same amount as what we spend now, and taking health care into account for that, and then options for either continuing to contribute and then borrowing against a retirement plan, which I actually know my husband's plan does have that option. And then the other thing is to maybe narrow down the contributions very low, but just keep putting something in and funnel the rest towards college.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Thank you for listening to the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I love your show. Thanks for having me on.
So let's get right back to our callers. We have Kayla with us from Berwyn, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kayla.
Hey there.
So walk us through your question. What's going on?
Well, I am 57. I worked in the corporate world for 25 years, saved my money, and took advantage of the miracle of compounding interest. And then I left the corporate world about 10 years ago to do something completely different and now run my own small businesses. I currently earn only about $30,000 a year after taxes. My expenses are at about $60,000, so I'm taking $30,000 a year from my portfolio. My question is, can I continue to do this and be okay through retirement, or am I living in fantasy land and should go get a real job again?
It's so fun in fantasy land, though.
It is.
And what's a real job mean to you?
Well, the corporate world was your basic 50, 60-hour work week in an office and high stress and all that kind of thing, and I'd really rather not go back to that.
What do you think, Jill?
Well, how much money did you squirrel away when you were working for the man?
My portfolio is about $740,000.
Mm-hmm. That expense number, when you said $60,000 a year, are those fixed expenses, or is there any squish room in that? Is it possible that we could drive it down to 50, or is it a real 60?
It's a real 60 now, but it will drop down to about 50 in 2016 between, hopefully, the health care stuff, and my son will be graduating from college with a degree in electrical engineering, so I'm hoping he'll actually be able to get a job.
Awesome. He will definitely get a job. Okay. So, you know, interesting, because I'm going to round up because I have to be able to do this math in my head. $750,000. One of the easiest ways to kind of say, well, how much can I take from that portfolio every year and not drain it would be to apply something that we call a withdrawal rate. And, you know, this is a huge contested issue in financial planning. When I first got into the business 100 years ago, they would say, oh, you could pull 6% of the value of your portfolio out every year and you'd be fine. Of course, that was when stocks were rising by 10 or 12% a year. I think now conventional wisdom says you could pick somewhere around 3 or 3.5% a year as a withdrawal rate. And, you know, you're probably going to be okay. So if I do a 3% of 750,000, I get to 22.5-ish. If I do 3.5%, I get to 26-ish. And that's about what you're doing, right? You're kind of pulling out this extra money. You're doing a little bit more than that, but for a few years, it wouldn't kill you to do it. In my mind, you're probably going to be okay. You know, you'll keep working. you'll continue to make money. Hopefully, you'll make a little bit more money. And when those expenses drop to $50,000, then the numbers actually look a lot better. So I don't want to, like, make you move out of fantasy land. I say that you sit up on that pink cloud and enjoy the view of us mere mortals working in the rat race.
That sounds wonderful.
That's the best advice I've heard you give anyone, Jill.
Thank you very much. You know, look, I just want to say that it is clear that, you know, if we have 10 years in a row where things were horrible, or if you had a huge downward trend in the market, it would be better if you could somehow force yourself to spend a little less in those kinds of years. That does make a difference. But, you know, overall, I think you should be okay. And it sounds like if you love what you're doing, you can keep doing it for a lot longer. And so, frankly, if you can keep working longer, that's one of the best ways to juice up your retirement anyway.
Well, yeah, my plan is to work and retire at 70. And at that point, my Social Security should be right around $29,000 a year. So
that's great.
I should basically be able to replace my working income with the Social Security. I do have a small pension that's frozen at $2,700 a year that would start at age 65, and they just now offered me the option to take it as a lump sum at $25,700 now. And when I run the numbers, it kind of depends on how long I live, whether which one makes more sense.
Tell us when you're going to die, and then we can build you a beautiful financial plan. You know, there is actually a website. I am not kidding you. There's a website that's called, I think it's called livingto100.com, livingto100.com. And you can plug in kind of like your family history, and it will give you a better estimate of when you will die. And then you could
and
actually
you can
play
plan
with
around
that.
It.
No, you could sort of at least when they ask you your life expectancy, rather than plugging in sort of a standard 90 or 95 if you're under the age of 50, you could put in something that more approximates your real number. But who knows? There's two schools of thought about that. I'm sure that, you know, the longer you live, taking the annual pension is better. On the other hand, having control of that lump sum today might give you some comfort to kind of beef up the amount of money in your retirement assets. And if it's really six, one half dozen the other, you go with like, hey, maybe I'd like a little bit of extra consistent income versus, give me the 25 G's right now.
Okay, great.
Kayla, I didn't ask you before about the business that you do now that you do like, the non-corporate man job.
Well, I have two businesses. The main one is it's a dog exercising business. And it's not dog walking, it's dog exercise. So we specialize in an hour of high-level cardio exercise for dogs.
So what does that mean?
We take dogs to the park. And we spend an hour at the park, and we're running, hiking, swimming, chasing things, all kinds of stuff. So they get the mental stimulation as well as the physical exercise. So when we take them back home, they are very tired and very happy.
That does sound like a great job.
I feel like I want that to sign up for myself.
You could start a franchise right now, yeah.
They see how happy their dogs are. They say, can I go along?
And what's your plan in retirement? What are you going to do after this?
Well, I want to get more involved in volunteer work and probably some traveling. But I own two dogs, and one of my dogs and I are a certified pet therapy team. So I'm in the process of getting to go with her to a rehab hospital to do some pet therapy work there. And I'm also getting involved in a local youth mentoring group. And I would just really like to get more and more involved in that kind of stuff.
As you think about, I mean, it seems like you've made choices to step out of the corporate world and now thinking about this really interesting volunteer work that you're hoping to do in retirement. Do you feel good about the choices you've made so far?
Yes. I left the corporate world because I'd gotten pretty burnt out, and they were moving my office into Center City, which would have meant longer commutes and time away from my son. So I decided that that was the kick in the butt I needed to go do something completely different. And I have never regretted it.
Kayla, thank you so much. It's a good story. You're doing great, it sounds like.
Thank you for taking my call.
I appreciate it. All right, Jill, we have an email for you now.
Okay.
Arthur wrote in from West Tisbury, Massachusetts. He inherited a home in another state just as the economy and the housing market sputtered. He's waiting for the market to improve before he sells it, and he wants to know, when's it going to be time to put the house back on the market? Is it today? Is it later? What do you say?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, this is a crystal ball question. And, you know, his crystal ball in Martha's Vineyard might be just as good as mine in New York City. Most people put their homes on the markets when they have to, right? They say, I've inherited this home and I need the money, or we have to settle the estate and they just have to fire sale the house. He's not in that situation. So that said, what do we know? We know that the housing market has been improving, and we bottomed out at the beginning of 2012. We've had 12% year-over-year increases in the last few months, and that's been really good. I think that the pace of price increases nationally is going to likely slow down, but the housing market should continue to firm. So the question is, what's it costing him to carry that house versus how much more do we think he can make by just being patient? Part of this has to do with how much of a burden this is to actually have this thing kicking around,
right?
And what's going on in the local economy where the other house is. So, you know, you usually have a lot of different variables, and it is a timing issue. It's one of those times where we say, you know, we say never time the market, except when you have to time the market. And this is a market timing question. So, you know, if you can be a little bit patient, it's not costing you a lot to carry the house, that I think that things will improve. But if you feel like, you know what, I've gotten a lot of the gains back from the middle of the worst part of this, and I'm comfortable with that, then go ahead and sell it. It's again, a bit of this is emotional, how much you feel like this is weighing you down.
And are there pitfalls here he should avoid?
You know, it's funny. I used to think that the best idea in the world was to go off and sell your house on your own, because you would save yourself all that commission. And what I have learned in my many, many, many years as being the daughter of a realtor is that my mother would hate when I would say things like that. But you know what? I think that listing a home with a really good realtor who's going to market your property and be very proactive and be honest with you. You know, you don't want to hire the realtor who's basically going to tell you what you want to hear. Hey, your house is worth way more than you thought. You want the person who looks you in the eye and says, Joe says it's way more than it's worth. Here's what the price is that we can move it. Here's what I'm going to do to market it. Here's my online strategy. Here's my physical strategy. And here's why I think you should give the listing to me. So do your research on a broker. Don't just hire the broker who your hairdresser told you to hire. Talk to these people and find out what they're going to do. You're going to pay them a lot of money, 5 or 6%. So make sure they're going to deliver the goods.
Any mistakes that you've made buying and selling property that you're willing to fess up to?
You know what? I would say that my biggest mistake in buying a property, that it's funny because they said this came from West Tisbury. So I owned a property on Martha's Vineyard myself. So that's why I knew where it was. And my mistake there was not understanding that the nature of the block that I was on was such that it was an access road where people brought their boats to go to this lake. And I thought, oh, I'm near the lake. That's so awesome. And I never thought that at 5 o'clock in the morning, the fishermen were coming down and going boom, 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 boom down the street. So it just tells you that, you know, you should. I think that now what I've learned is I always talk to people in the neighborhood. I've bought and sold things since then. And I've talked to people in the neighborhood. If you live in a big city, ask the questions on the ground. I think that can save you a lot of heartache down the road.
All right. Thanks so much, Jill. We got an email from a woman named Mary in Michigan. And let me set this up a little. She's 60 years old. She's a widow. She lives in Michigan. She wants to move to Chicago where her family is. And her first question is, she's heard that you shouldn't buy a home until you sell the home you have. But she's worried if she waits, she's not going to be able to get in at a good price. So what do you say?
You know, it kind of depends on how much money you have. If Mary's got $10 million socked away and she wants to carry two $500,000 homes, okay, I can live with that. Do we know what her net worth is about?
Yeah, I think she's got about $1 million.
She's got $1 million, which is a good chunk of money. She's 60 years old, and we now know our rule of thumb, which is the withdrawal rate
yes.
that we can apply to that is, you know, somewhere around she'll have 30 grand a year that can come in. Okay,
3 to 3.5%, right?
That's right. 3 to 3.5%. So I'll go 3% because I'll be err on the side of being conservative.
Okay.
She can pull 30 grand from that. I don't know if she has a pension or not, but it would not make me happy as the advisor to have a big chunk of that $1 million tied up in a second home. The first answer is no, you do not buy the second home until you sell the first home.
Okay.
And I know that that can be very frustrating to people, and they might feel like prices are getting much more expensive in the place I want to be. It's still a more prudent course of action to sell your house, then buy the next house.
even if it's frustrating, go ahead and try to wait it out.
I think so. I really do. And you know what? It takes a while to sell houses. And every time that we hear from people who say, I sold my house in one day, you hear four more stories of it took 6, 8, 12 months.
Mm-hmm. So another part of Mary's email she wrote, she said, this is all new to me since my husband did so much of the money stuff. And her husband, again, has passed away. She writes, I'm so scared I'll do the wrong thing.
Oh,
yeah.
That makes me sad. Well, you know, she doesn't have to be so scared. I think that this is such a great example, and we hear these stories all the time. Widows and widowers who are left behind, who are really not the family chief financial officer. They might be the CEO of the family. They might be the chief marketing officer. They
right.
might be the chief operating officer, but they're not the financial officer of the family. And, you know, it just drives home the point that, you know, I know that no matter what, you think you're 40 years old, you're 30 years old, you're 20 years old, you think nothing bad's going to happen to you, but something bad could happen to you. So I really do recommend, it's okay to allocate labor, right? You are going to take care of the finances,
right,
honey. You do that really well. But you've got to check in with your mate, the non-CFO. You've got to check in and say, look, here's our game plan. Here's what our portfolio is. The non-CFO spouse will often be like, I don't want to know about it.
Exactly.
You're doing a good job.
Please
and
leave
so
me
you,
out of it.
Leave me out of it. And the answer to that is, you know what? I don't want to have to worry that you will be left feeling scared and anxious about money. I mean, look at this. A woman is 60 years old. She's got $1 million. And there's no reason why she needs to feel scared about this.
Right.
If you are someone who manages your money on your own and you don't have an advisor, something that is really a very interesting thing to consider is as you're getting older, is you might want to pay a fee-only advisor to help bring that conversation to fruition, to say, sit down and say, hey, I'd like another set of eyes. And then when you're gone, if your spouse doesn't really want to do it, there is an advisor there waiting to help. Again, a fee-only advisor, maybe someone hourly at the beginning. But imagine if Mary could turn around and say, hey, Adrian, remember I met with you 2 years ago? Well, unfortunately, my husband has passed away. I really liked you. I felt like really confident in the information you were able to communicate to me. I would like to hire you not just by the hour. I would actually like to hire you to manage this $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a much more seamless way to bridge this gap. So the conversation has to happen. The conversation has to happen with, if you're working with an advisor, you bring the non-CFO spouse in to really get that person on the same page. If they are reluctant to do so, pull the guilt card. It works. You know, I don't want to worry about you, honey. And really try to make these conversations happen. I know they're hard. It's like estate planning. Nobody wants to have the conversation. Look, when I die, this is how things are going to be laid out. But, you know, these conversations really will spare the surviving spouse a lot of anxiety at a time where, you know what, I got other things to worry about. I want to mourn my husband. I want to mourn my wife. I don't want to have to worry about money.
Now, what if the CFO partner is the one who's just not willing to sort of take the time to talk it through?
Well, that's when you put your foot down. And I actually have had that experience many times where someone will come in and the husband will say, you know, I didn't want to be here, but she wanted me to come in. And
I know
say,
what
oh,
I'm doing. Please
I know
leave
what
me
I'm
alone.
Doing. And right. Of course you do, because, you know, you sit there and you say, look, just it doesn't cost anything but an hour of your time. Okay. So I was listening to the radio and these two women were talking on the air and I heard them talk about a 60-year-old woman. Well, that could be a 50-year-old woman. Right. I had a 36-year-old client who died and she hired me when she was given a terminal diagnosis so that I could work with her would then be surviving spouse, her husband, to help him manage their finances because he didn't do it. She did everything. Can you imagine me getting that call?
No.
Hi, I'm blank. I'm 36 years old. I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and I'd like to hire you to help me transition all these activities that I've been doing to my husband.
Wow.
That's intense, right?
It is intense.
And you know what? That is like the greatest gift that she could have given to him because he even said in the aftermath, like, I don't know what I would have done if this was just dumped in my lap. I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Jill, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News and a personal finance expert.